welcome to the second in the spring series of the Vancouver Institute. This evening we are very pleased to have as the Dal Grauer Memorial Lecturers Professors Albert Breton and Raymond Breton. Professor Albert Breton was born in Saskatchewan, received his PhD from Columbia University in the field of economics. He has been on the faculty of the Université de Montréal, of the London School of Economics, and most recently of the University of Toronto. He's been a visiting professor at a number of universities, a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, and has contributed extensively to the literature in the field of Canadian economics. His brother, Professor Raymond Breton, received his PhD from Johns Hopkins University in the field of sociology. He has served on the faculties of the Université de Montréal, McGill University, Johns Hopkins University, and is now also on the faculty of the University of Toronto. Also a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, and last year was named Director of Research for the Institute of Research on Public Policy. They will each address you this evening, and then we will have a joint question session following their talks. And the topic for tonight is Quebec and the dynamics of contemporary Canada. The first speaker will be Professor Albert Breton.
Thank you very much. I will introduce the subject for a few minutes, and then my brother, as indicated, will pick from there and continue essentially on what I will have begun. What I intend to do is to essentially summarize the material we have been delivering over the last week here in Vancouver. Let me begin by saying that we will take as axiomatic, and I hope that you will agree with us, that there exists in Canada some tensions between the two language communities, that there is unease, and that there is, if not actual, a potential for conflict. Let us take also as axiomatic that there exists unease, with the possibility of conflict or tensions between the regions of Canada. For all intent and purposes, these regions are Quebec, Ontario, and the West, by which I mean Alberta and British Columbia. What we will be talking about will be about the nature and the characteristics of these tensions, and we will try to provide, or I will try in my part, to provide an explanation of why it is that these tensions exist. Let me say that we will look in one particular domain or area to try to locate the origin of these tensions. We will, and I will try to explain, but we have essentially assumed or tried to demonstrate that the origin of the tensions is essentially linked to the distribution of power. Not constitutional powers, I will return to this, but I will define what I mean, but the distribution of power in Canada and to efforts on the part of some of these, of the communities, linguistic and regional, to change the distribution of power. When we began our work quite some time ago for these lectures, we looked at the available evidence to see whether it would make sense to assume that the locus of the conflicts and tensions which we took to exist could be located in this problem of the regional distribution of power and efforts to change that distribution, regional and linguistic. In view of the fact that we felt that in talking about the problems of Canadian society, it was very difficult in that particular area that we had been asked to consider, to observe that essentially it was the poor who were preoccupied. We could see nowhere in that the tensions were felt or voiced by the poor, or even by those who weren't poor but had no power, no decision-making authority in the country. We thought we could locate that those who felt and voiced the existence of tensions between the linguistic and regional communities were essentially among the elites of the country. Since we were not able, sifting through the evidence, empirical and qualitative, I should say quantitative and qualitative, to essentially find that this was crystallized elsewhere than among the elites, we decided that the tensions could not be found in efforts to change the distribution of income or wealth, that this was not the prime dynamics of Canadian society at the present time, at least at the level at which we are talking, namely at the level of the relationship between the regional and linguistic communities. This is the reason why we were led to talk and to examine problems related to the distribution of power. Let me emphasize right now that by power, we do not mean the power that is located, we do not exclusively mean the power located in governments. We mean the power that exists in all organizations of society. And I'm going to be talking, and Raymond is going to be talking, about what we will call organizational power or organizational control. We use these two words as synonyms. Organizations are bodies such as governments, I've mentioned governments, but they include business corporations, law partnerships, they include churches, they include private and public bureaucracies, they include financial institutions, they include labor unions, so all the organizations that exist in society. In other words, our view in analyzing the particular problem we're looking at is not to look at society as a collection of individuals or families, but to look at society as a collection of organizations in which individuals operate. We are not denying, of course, that individuals do engage in actions of their own on a purely individual basis. No one can deny this, but we are focusing on the action of individuals as members of organizations of the type that I have mentioned. We claim, and in particular tonight, we just assert, that in every organization there exists discretionary power in the hands of those people who are in the command structure of organizations. This discretionary power, or organizational control or power, is, if you wish, the capacity that people in command have to make decisions with respect to promotions of individuals, with respect to the kind of markets that will be exploited, with respect to the kind of technology that will be accepted or rejected, with respect to the which political party will be supported, etc. Individuals This power, this control, is something real. It's something which is different than the income, the money income that people derive from organizations. But it is something that has a value to the individuals who own it, who possess that control. They can use it to make decisions which are beneficial for themselves, for the group in which they are, or for the society in which they live, and therefore it has value. Since it has value, individuals would like to have some. And if they want to have some, they will use up some of the resources over which they have command. Time is a resource over which they have command. Energy, money, talent, skills are all resources that individuals have some quantity of, and they can use to acquire organizational control or organizational power. Consequently, we will think of organizational control as a form of capital, if you want, in which individuals invest resources for the yield that it provides them. There are two things related to this kind of capital. It can be increased. It can be increased by developing new organizations or by increasing the size of those that exist. The second problem is that the existing stock of organizational control, a kind of capital, has got to be allocated between the various individuals who wish to have some. I mentioned that individuals would use the resources at their command to invest in that form of capital. They would use up their skills, their money, their time, not all of it, but the part to which they want to. And that provides them with a certain quantity of organizational control. If all individuals in society, Francophones and Anglophones, Westerners and Easterners, could purchase the quantity of organizational control that they wish to purchase with the resources that they have, and if there were no restrictions or limitations other than the amount of resources they have command over in the investment of in purchasing organizational control, we claim that even though there would be conflicts still, they would be the kind of conflicts that exist that arise from the fact that I may want to have my own airplane, but I do not have the money to buy one, and therefore I don't get too frustrated at myself from not being able to purchase an airplane. So. And not too frustrated at those individuals who do buy. We wish to emphasize that there is, besides the resources over which individuals have command, which is a constraint, which prevents them from buying all they want, but within which they are willing to operate, that there exists another class of restrictions or limitations on the purchase of organizational control. That class has three dimensions. And let me be very brief about what that class of limitations is. There is first the fact that if an individual, let's not be too abstract, so I'll talk about Francophones and Anglophones. If you want to substitute Easterners or Westerners, it's all right with me. If you want to put blacks and whites, it's all right. I mean, we can talk of different communities. Not in Canada in that case, but in the world or elsewhere. But I'll talk of Francophones and Anglophones. Let us and to be close to what's going on in the world, I will assume that the organizational system of Francophones is much smaller than that of Anglophones, and that the institutions of French Canada are less important and less complex and less involved relative to those of English Canada. Let us assume that a Francophone or a group of Francophones want to buy organizational control in Anglophone organizations. Then two possibilities out of this first class of restrictions I'm talking about can arise. First, there might be resistance on the part of Francophones themselves to see other Francophones moving. They could be worried, in particular, if there are too many Francophones moving out to Anglophone organizations, because that threatens the capacity to maintain their own organizational system. And consequently, they may make appeals to loyalty or call those who do move in the organization of Anglophones. They may call them traitors when they're polite. There might be limitations originating on the other side. If Anglophones in Anglophone organizations feel that there is a large number of Francophones coming over to work in the organizations and to acquire organizational control, they may feel that the organization is being threatened by a takeover on the part of the Francophones, and they will build resistance to try to prevent this from happening. So this is the first class of restrictions which prevent individuals from acquiring as much organizational control as they would want to, and it is a restriction which is independent of the amount of resources over which individuals have command. A second class of restriction originates in the fact that within each community, to restrict ourselves again to Francophones and Anglophones, there are networks. Networks of trust, networks of information, which follow the frontiers or the boundaries of the linguistic communities to some extent. They're not completely closed, but these networks are to a very large extent internal to each of the sub-societies. So that it's very difficult for an individual to move from one to the other, for an Anglophone to acquire control in the Francophone society, and vice versa, essentially because the patterns of trust are not there, and the patterns of and the information about the functioning and the working institutions and labor markets in the societies are not there. So again, this is a second form of limitation. A third form of limitation is outright discrimination and nepotism. A good example of discrimination is provided by language itself. There is no way that the Francophone can acquire organizational control in Anglophone organizations without becoming bilingual. Bilingual is not an absolute barrier to acquiring organizational control in Anglophone institutions, because with the expenditure of time, money, energy, one can become bilingual. But if one does become bilingual and one is prevented from acquiring control in Anglophone institutions because one is Francophone, then we call that discrimination. Nepotism is the obverse of discrimination. And since my time is fast running out, I'm sorry, I will not dwell on it. These restrictions to the purchase, these non-resource-using restrictions, if you wish, to the acquisition of organizational control across linguistic and regional communities, imply that the distribution of organizational control in a country such as Canada will follow the dimensions of language and the dimensions of region. So that to stay with what I'm talking about, we will have more organizational control, for example, in Anglophone organizations with barriers that prevent Francophones from buying some and vice versa, and at the regional levels, it will be difficult for Easterners to buy control in the West and vice versa, for Westerners to buy control in organizations in the East, Ontario, the East. we call the East, but we mean Ontario. Now, I will not spend any time or virtually no time in explaining why it is that some individuals, let's call them in this particular case, Francophones and Westerners. Let's assume that that some members of these communities or sub-societies in Canada want, for all kinds of reasons, because of technological change, because of the growth of a petroleum industry, because of more education, because of all kinds of reasons, they want to change that distribution of power, of organizational power that is embedded in the country as a result of the working of the forces I've indicated. Let's say these individuals wish to change that distribution. They want a different one. What can they do? Well, there are three things they can do. They can adopt three different classes of strategies. We're going to give three names to them. One is individual strategies. They can act individually alone. With the second class, we're going to call corporate strategies. The language may not be too felicitous, but I will try to define what we mean. And the third type of strategies we call collective strategies. Individual strategies are exactly what the word means. Individuals acting by themselves may decide to use the resources they have to try to promote in institutions. They learn the rules of the game, they work hard, they follow the rules in the institutions, and they try to promote within it. That is, acquire more control so that they get to be in the command structure of the organization. These are things that, as a rule, when people talk about the conflicts that exist between the communities, is recommended by those who do not want any social change. That is what is recommended to be the proper strategies. But individuals, they're not very powerful, the individual strategies to deal with the kind of problems we mentioned. Consequently, we expect to see individuals engage in corporate strategies and in collective strategies. Corporate strategies, by this we mean the actions aimed at developing the organizations themselves in which individuals are, or enlarging the organizational domain, building new organizations, and by getting groups together, trying to borrow money and developing new organizations in industry, in commerce, in finance, in education, in various fields, in all the possible fields of human endeavor. The third type of strategies that individuals can use are collective strategies. These strategies are essentially to try to mobilize socio-political factors or instruments and ideologies to enlarge the organizational domain. They consist in trying to use the apparatus of the state, for example, to try to achieve an enlargement of the domain or the stock of organizational control or power, and or other institutions. We argued in one lecture this week that for a long time, essentially, the instruments that French Quebecers use were related to the church, whereas now they are related to the state. The collective strategy is mostly, not exclusively, through the use of the state. I'm ending in a minute. It is the use of these strategies to try to change the distribution of organizational power in society between the sub-societies of the country that is the cause of the tensions. It is the use of these strategies which is the cause of the unease, which is the cause of the conflicts that exist between the sub-societies of Canada, the communities of Canada. It is, therefore, a bit of an illusion to believe that rewriting the Constitution will change very, very much, by which I would not want to be quoted as saying that I'm against a revision of the Constitution. I'm not saying anything of that kind. I'm not going to tell you what I stand for on that. I'll keep one secret away from you. But one should not expect too much. If our analysis is at all correct, changing the Constitution, changing the distribution of constitutional powers, as lawyers call them, or changing the distribution of functions, as economists call the same thing, will not change the distribution of organizational power automatically. It may help, but it could hinder, and it's not obvious that it would. It is therefore very important that in thinking of the problems of our society, we think of ways of approaching these problems in terms of the, I don't want to use the word solution, but in terms of the ways of thinking of solutions in terms which are appropriate to the nature of the problem we face. Thank you.
I will simply continue, in fact, on take off from what Albert has been saying. He's been talking about the fact that you have in the language communities and regional communities in Canada some groups and individuals who have become dissatisfied in recent years with the amount of organizational control in their hands. And therefore, they wish to have a better deal in that regard. He has also pointed out, and I'd like to emphasize it because it's quite important in terms of the implications of what he's been saying, that we are not talking about the redistribution of income. We're not talking about programs to reduce unemployment or programs to give more welfare. So there's been a lot of discussion in recent years in Canada as to whether the federal government was redistributing taxes in the right way, and helping individuals in the poor parts of the country sufficiently, etc. The issue, although these kinds of policies have validity in their own right, they're not the kinds of issues that we're talking about today. What we're talking about in terms of the framework is something more fundamental. We're talking about the redistribution of the means of economic development, namely redistribution of control over the resources whereby you can create organizations or expand organizations. Now, when individuals attempt to obtain a redistribution of such control, they're very well likely to emerge conflicts or resistance. And I will try to talk a little bit about the kinds of tensions that may originate from this, the reasons why they would originate, and some of the implications of the analysis presented in terms of reducing the possibility of intense conflicts or what we could call socially costly conflicts. So a new distribution is desired, whether we like it or not, is desired, and groups will attempt to obtain it. Now, one way to avoid conflicts would be to have strategies that would consist in raising the number of, of expanding organizations or creating organizations in all of the sub-societies of Canada, Eastern, Western, French and English, or Francophone and Anglophone, if you prefer. In this way, the amount of resources under the control of the various groups and the various sub-societies or communities would be raised all across the board. And presumably everybody would be a little bit happier without really having lost anything. There's a limitation to this kind of strategy, though. is that the relative positions of the various sub-societies have not changed at all. And one reason why this is not going to be considered sufficient is that, as Albert pointed out, the different organizations of the different sub-societies, like, say, the Anglophone organizations, tend to be bigger, they tend to be more numerous, they tend to command more resources, so the decisions which are taken in them have more impact. And they have impact on the organizations of the Francophone society, which are less powerful, control less resources, tend to be smaller and less numerous. So there will be, and I could say the same thing for region, but I won't repeat it. You can just repeat it in your own minds. So that there's likely to be groups who will want to change the hierarchy of organization. They would want to have a better deal in terms of the relative amount of organizational control they have, so that their bargaining power is better, is improved, and they can thus command more resources to develop their own organizational systems. Now, in this kind of a situation, the approach would be the following to avoid too much conflict. It would be to have strategies that would, say, help Westerners or people in the Maritimes or Francophones to develop their organizational systems, perhaps at a more rapid rate than those of the other sub-societies, but making sure that the others don't lose anything, absolutely speaking. Because if Ontario, for example, or if Anglophone Canada feels that they're losing in absolute terms, and not only in relative terms, they will resent it very bitterly, and there are likely to be very intense conflicts. So the strategy would be to try to improve those who are less well off without damaging those who are fairly well off already. Now, this is likely to generate conflict even though you do this, because in order to improve, to help in a region in the country or a linguistic community improve its condition, you will have to take some resources of the society and direct them in that direction, which will mean that the regions and communities who are better off will have that much less resources to develop their own organizational system. In fact, a few years ago, in the mid-60s around, when the federal government began a program of regional economic expansion, taking societal resources through taxation, redirecting them in some regions of the country to help them develop organizations, that is, industries, firms of various sorts, etc., some of the richer provinces and regions of the country objected very strongly. They felt that this would slow down their own rate of growth, the rate of growth of their own organizations, and they resisted. But the resistance was not enormous, because at least they were not losing absolutely. Now, if a loss, an absolute loss, is going to generate tension and conflicts, you can imagine a situation if one group tries to weaken the organization of the other, then there will be really profound resentment. For example, if you have a policy whose aim it is to weaken the educational system of a collectivity by putting language restrictions. This has happened historically all over the country in Canada. Depending on which period of time, it'll be a different period of the country, the most recent being the one in Quebec. The community that is affected, that is, whose organizational system is affected by such policies, because it's threatened to be weakened, resents it and starts putting a fight, at least to a certain degree. Now, one of the reasons why these kinds of situations should be avoided is because they're socially wasteful. If you try to weaken the institutional system of another group, first you're losing resources, because it takes resources to weaken the other guy in his organizations. And second, by trying to do this, you eliminate the possibility of mutually advantageous exchanges. And I'd like to come to this second point of my comment about the importance of exchange between communities, language, linguistic and regional communities in Canada. It is futile in today's world to think of organizational systems as being self-sufficient or as not being interdependent. This is true of sub-societies and it's true of entire sub-societies. There is no organizational system, economic, political, educational, whatever, who can function on its own without exchanging with some other organizations. I'd like to emphasize, we're talking about exchange between organizations, not between individuals only. Now, one implication of this, if exchange, and I think it's difficult to argue that exchange is not mutually beneficial, or can at least be mutually beneficial. If it is, then the strategy would be to try to encourage exchange among organizations between East and West, or between Anglophone and Francophone organizations. Exchanges that would be mutually beneficial. Now, how the question is to provide the conditions to facilitate such exchanges. In fact, I've been working on a study recently trying to find out how much work there's been in Canada to examine the conditions under which, for example, Francophone and Anglophones get together to pool their resources to start common ventures. There seems to be very little instances of that. And those that exist, I don't think have ever been studied. So we don't know the condition under which Francophones and Anglophones could pool their resources. Because we know that any organization, just like an individual, does not possess the resources, all the resources he needs to pursue his activities. You usually have to get resources from somebody else, either in the form of exchange or in the form of pooling resources. It seems to me that those kinds of strategies should be developed very, very systematically, and it would raise, by mutual exchanges, the total level of the number of organizations and the level of organizational control in the society. Now, this means that we put an emphasis on the building of networks, horizontal networks, across societies. There's been a lot of talk, for example, in recent years. You may have read this, in fact, even recently in the papers. Mr. Keith Spicer has been arguing in favor of movements of Canadians across the country so that we know the country better. We are not talking about this kind of exchanges, of which I have, in fact, serious doubts of their validity, or their value and their impact. We're talking about linkages, exchanges among individuals, of course, because it's individuals who travel, not organizations, but as agents of organizations. That is, there would be linkages among individuals that would facilitate exchanges between organizations, whether, again, these organizations are educational, professional, financial, industrial, or whatever. In other words, the idea is that conflicts can be avoided if people find relationships that they will find mutually beneficial. It's sort of simple-minded, but somehow we've missed the point for a long time in this country in that regard. I think this is true not only between Francophones and Anglophones, it's true also across regions, although I think the absence of linkages, organizational linkages, is more pronounced in the case of the Francophones and Anglophones. Now, one condition for such linkages to occur is that you need a class of bilinguals in the case of linguistic communities. Exchanges and linkages between organizations that will be mutually profitable cannot really occur if people don't understand each other. Language is a means of communication. It's something that you need to actually engage into transactions. If there is not at least one of the parties that speaks the language of the other, there will be no transaction. Now, if you want to systematize relationships across the societies, you need at least a certain class of individuals in the two collectivities who will bear the cost of becoming bilingual so as to facilitate those kinds of exchanges. Failing that, it's difficult to imagine. If you imagine a situation where nobody is bilingual, then there will be no exchange at all. In fact, there will be two completely parallel organizational systems with no exchange between each other. Now, another point is that, in terms of exchanges, is that you could even argue that it would be to the advantage of English Canada to put resources to build the organizations of French Canada. Because it's more profitable to exchange with someone who has more resources. Exchange with someone who is very poor, you're not going to make a very good deal. He doesn't have much to offer, he's poor. So in order to have good, profitable exchanges, it's better to exchange with someone who has at least as much resources as you have. And therefore, you're more likely to make a profitable exchange. So following this kind of reasoning, you could argue that it would be the interest of the more powerful organizational system to assist the development of the less powerful organizational system in anticipation of more profitable exchanges in the future. I don't think this has occurred in Canada. I don't think, for example, that if you take the case of Quebec, that the English community in Quebec has invested any money in technological development institutions, such as at the University of Montreal or at Laval University. The Anglophone community in Quebec invested its money to develop science and technology at McGill in its own institutions, not in the institution of the other gang. So, mutually profitable exchanges between the two sets of organizations have remained at a very low level. Now, Albert mentioned that there are restrictions to mobility that can exist, and that becomes an incentive for people to develop their own organizations. There has been, in fact, if you look at it from that point of view, an interesting debate going on in Canada in the last, maybe at least 15 years, but it's been very intense in the last 4 or 5 years. And the debate is whether you should have policies to eliminate the restrictions to mobility, have policies that would facilitate the mobility of Canadians all over the place, French and English moving back and forth, and or mobility across regions, or whether the policy should be such as to help each of the weaker organizational systems, such as in the West or in the French, in the Francophone organizational system, to develop. So you have really a difference here in two kinds of approaches to the problem. One would be essentially, if you wish, assimilationist. Or maybe a better word would be integrationist. That is, you try to make it such that many Francophones would become part of Anglophone institutions and some Anglophones part of Francophone institutions, so you'd have mobility of individuals. In fact, that debate, if you allow me a little digression, has been very much cast in the context of what I call two conceptions of Canada. One is the pan-Canadian conception of Canada, and the other one is the segmentalist conception of Canada. I'll explain what those two words were, but you can understand probably they're just by the imagery. The two conceptions of the Canadian reality, and you will see these two conceptions are confronting one another, and Canadians have a lot of trouble making up their minds as to which ones to choose. We're not always consistent, and they do connect with these two kinds of approaches. To the question, for example, what is English Canada and what is French Canada? The pan-Canadian says French Canada, that's the Francophone community from coast to coast, from one Atlantic to the other, as Albert said the other day, jokingly. And English Canada is also the Anglophone community from one ocean to the other. The segmentalist says, no, French Canada, its homeland is Quebec. And the homeland of English Canada is the rest of the country. These are very different ways of conceiving Canada. And there are some Canadians, in terms of their gut reactions, as well as in terms of their philosophy, who think of the country in either one or the other of these two ways. Also, there are different ideologies that correspond with this, social ideologies. The pan-Canadian conception of Canada is based essentially on an individualistic ideology. That is, the the individual is what counts, and the individual is the one that relates to the institutions. Therefore, we should encourage mobility of individuals. An individual should be able to find a niche anywhere he pleases in the country that would maximize the pursuit of his own benefits, of his own condition. The segmentalist perspective, on the other hand, focuses on the community rather than the individual. In this view, communities have rights as well as individuals. In fact, in the pan-Canadian conception, it's individuals who have rights primarily. In the segmentalist conception, it's communities that have rights to survival, for example. So as you can see, these two conceptions of Canada confront one another, and in a way, one choice that has to be made in terms of the issue that we've been discussing is whether it's more appropriate to try to develop the organizational systems, redistribute organizational control, or whether we should have policies and approaches aimed at facilitating mobility of individuals. The fact that you have these different conceptions, the different approaches which are being debated, makes it more difficult. I mean, it increases the level of conflicts. You have within the French community, within the English community, some conflicts between groups as to what is the right way of approaching these problems. Our time is almost up. Let me finish by pointing out one last thing. We've mentioned in our discussions, the previous lectures, that when you have community, when it tries to gain more organizational control and expand its organizations, it will tend to use bargaining strategies because it has a lot of resources and it can go into bargains with others who have complementary resources that they need to expand further their own organizations. But if you're weak, if you don't have much resources, or if you have primarily social resources, such as social cohesion, social solidarity, a sense of belonging to a common community, or resources such as a government at your disposal, you will tend to use pressure strategies, or what you could call also confrontation strategies. You will try to pressure because you don't, and these are you don't something that you don't bargain with. You will tend to use strategies to force the other to make concessions, because you can't bargain too much with him. You don't have anything to bargain with. That is, you don't have as much to bargain with as you would need in order to get what you want. Now, I'd like to point out some of the dangers of confrontation strategies. One, the main danger, of course, is that it can create retaliation. That is, if the weaker party, the weaker set of organizations, start pushing too hard, they're likely to be clobbered by the more powerful. When I say clobbered, I don't mean that the use of force necessarily, but they can be also subject, for example, economic reprisals. You decide that you won't deal with them anymore. You withdraw your capital. You stop entering into transactions with them. And that weakens further and further their organizational system. In a way, it's a form of punishing them for putting pressure. And this is disastrous because, of course, the less powerful group who is being sort of, if you wish, punished, in parentheses, for using pressure strategies, of course, doesn't benefit from this, nor does the group applying the pressures. Because the group applying the pressure is actually using resources to punish the other group, and also does not engage into profitable transactions. So it also loses. So those kinds of dynamics where groups put pressure on each other like this are overall socially counterproductive. So what I've tried to argue here is that in order to avoid conflicts, there are issues or approaches that have to do with the amount of resources to be invested, the way they're going to be distributed, to avoid complete losses or absolute losses, on the part of one collectivity. Try to avoid using strategies that can call for retaliation. and punishments of various sorts, and finally have approaches that increases the amount, and I think these are the most important, that increases the amount of exchanges and linkages between the organizations of the various sub-societies. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we would now like to move to the question format, and I would ask you to direct your questions perhaps to either of the speakers, and that will give them an opportunity either individually to reply, or if it's a question that both wish to speak to, I think that would be quite appropriate also. So are there questions? Yes.
As French Canadians who have lived for quite a part of your life in the Anglophone community, have you maintained your pan-Canadian views, or are you segmentalists, basically?
Perhaps if I repeat the questions, it will ensure that all of the audience can hear them. I think it can be briefly summarized as, are you pan-Canadians, or do you hold a segmentalist view of the country?
Well, our posture up to now has been to try to reveal as little of our own political views as possible, to take an analytic stand and look at the confrontation in society. But my view would be that the tendency in Canada, and perhaps I should have mentioned that, has been to see these two positions as opposites. And I think they're not really opposites. They're complementary to one another. In other words, if, for example, the Francophone organizational system wants to develop itself, it would be profitable for it to have a number of Francophones in Anglophone organizations. That would facilitate the linkages that I've been talking about and facilitate, presumably, the exchanges, unless the Francophones who moved have been forced to assimilate totally, to abandon completely any of their identification with their own communities in order to move up. But if they haven't, if they've not had to do that, then they could provide bridges between the two communities. So in that sense, a pan-Canadian view that would facilitate mobility across the country is not a view that is an opposite to the other. So my personal view would be really one of a sociologist, to tell you the truth, rather than one that derives from my own personal experience, if you wish. I think in terms of my personal experience, I would sort of have a gut reaction of moving more in the pan-Canadian direction. But as a sociologist, I've learned that one has to moderate one's own, the impact of one's own personal experience by proper analysis. And that would be my view, that they really complement one another up to a certain point.
The question is, there is a perception that most of the people holding power are in Ontario, and shouldn't we be somewhat suspicious, therefore, of people from Toronto defining the problem?
I suppose you should, but then you should be more suspicious if I attempted to answer your question.
In my opinion, the federal government of Canada, none of the political parties or any of the MPs have any right to vote on a bilingual bill, nor have the federal government any right to put a bilingual bill into the country. Before we bring the BNA Act from London to Ottawa, and then make the necessary alterations. In other words, I maintain that the bilingual bill in Canada is illegal. Definitely. Now, I'd like to have you for comment on that.
The question that has been asked is for a comment on the legality of the federal bilingual bill.
Is it legal or illegal? Is it legal or illegal? A simple question.
I'm not a lawyer.
I'm afraid I don't know that.
But I imagine it is, yes. Would be my view that it is. I would suppose that someone would take the issue to the courts if it wasn't.
Well, in my opinion, and it's a legal opinion, it is definitely illegal. Okay?
Yes. If I could summarize the comment, it's that not only are our speakers from Toronto, but they are both men.
For which we apologize.
And the question...
The latter, not the former.
The question is that it may be perceived from the United States, if one is to believe Time magazine, that country would see it as an advantage were Canada to be segmented, and that in itself might be a unifying force, I suppose, in the country. And would the speakers comment on that aspect of the issue?
Well, just a word on the first point, the facetious point you raised. We talked of sub-societies as system of organizations which are ongoing. Now, sub-societies of Francophones can exist, of Anglophones, Western, Eastern, but society exclusively of women or of men would, we suspect, not last very long. And the conflict that could exist would resolve itself to attrition. On the question of... the question you raise is one that important. I don't know how to answer it, except to say that even though the possibility of an external threat does sometimes act as a means of diversion. We know that, for example, it's practice and to a very large extent in totalitarian regimes, also in the non-totalitarian. I doubt that in the longer run such external threat could act as a substitute for a real change in what we call the distribution of power or organizational power in Canada. It could delay, it could possibly partially impede in the short run the kind of conflicts that exist, But I, for one, very doubtful about the long-run stability that would result from the fact that we are able to maintain the show with the existing status quo, just on the hope that the Americans would always be there as a threat in the case we broke up.
Well, I'd like to add one comment on this. Looking at it from the point of view of the Americans, your hypothesis is essentially that the Americans have an interest in divide and conquer approach. The Time magazine. Yeah. So the Time magazine article used essentially the divide and conquer approach, that it's in the interest of the United States to divide Canada, and this way they would have derive greater benefits. That there are some interests in the United States, some groups who have such an interest, is probably, undeniable. I think we should be careful of lumping all the United States in a single package, and there probably is just as many groups in the United States who have an interest in the unified Canada. And I'm talking about sheer interest. I'm not talking about emotionalism. I'm talking about their interests. The second point I'd like to make about this is that even though I'm always a little bit suspicious of those theory that which see someone's dividing us, for example, I'd like to visualize the kind of means they use for that. See, in what ways are Americans, and what kind of strategies are they using? What kind of tactics are they using to divide the East from the West, or to divide the French from the English? I think this is it should be spelled out by those who put forth the hypothesis, because I would think that the forces of division are much more within Canada than fostered. That doesn't mean that some don't have an interest, but having an interest in doing something about it that we can actually visualize, and see, observe, is another matter. So that would be, I would be very careful about these kinds of this kind of hypotheses.
Question is, in discussing this issue, how can one avoid the question of the history of the people of Quebec and also of the Canadian people?
I think that I can only answer in a way which is unfair to your question by saying that we essentially limited to 1 hour. But that in what we wrote, we tried to take into account, in some instances, on Thursday, we tried to give some sort of a schematic view of history. But seriously, the point I would make is that there is no way of talking about this without bringing history. And your point is very well taken. One has to know the history. But our reading, and we have been engaged separately and together in rereading some of the history of Canada that we had done while younger within the framework that we have been working on in the last year, 14 months. And it's quite interesting. It does provide a different view and a different perspective. It is our intention to, we have written down the conferences, and we have separately and together common friends who are historians, and we certainly intend to talk with them and to show them their our material to see the extent to which it's consistent with history.
I just wanted to make a few comments that are basically in opposition to what the speakers have been saying. What they describe as the acquisition of organizational control, I claim it's not a practice of everyone in society. It's not a practice, for example, of ordinary working men and women. But it is a pastime, this grasping for power, of that tiny fraction of Canadian society, which is known as, you can call the ruling class. Speaking roughly, that is the very rich, their state machine, and upper-level professionals. But the reason I bring up this point is that it's a very significant point in light of this great debate that's national unity and independence for Quebec. Now, there is a very real conflict raging over this debate, but the source of this conflict and its real basis is within the ruling class, I claim. However, the two warring sections of the ruling class, the section headed by Trudeau and that headed by Lévesque, they're trying to line up the Canadian people behind one section or the other. But both these sections of the bourgeoisie are made up of traitors who make their living by selling Canada to the foreign imperialists, especially the U.S.
I wonder if you could address a question to the speakers this evening.
I'd like to hear the comments on these views, which are very different. I think it'll take a minute or two just to outline them.
Well, I think we should take the first one in that case because there are a number of other people wishing to ask questions.
It's
would
not
you?
Much longer. This goes on to say that the Quebec section of this reactionary ruling class, which has perhaps run into some of these barriers that the Breton spoke of, trying to grab control, they want to have total control over the benefits from the sale of Quebec.
Right.
So the conflict is over the spoils of selling Quebec to the U.S. imperialists. That's one thing I'd like to hear your comment on. I claim that the overwhelming majority of the Canadian people have no real interest in lining up behind either side of this battle, raging within the ruling class. The working class and people of Canada have many real problems of their own, such as unemployment and inflation, all these problems that are thrust upon them by the capitalist system, the rulers. This series of lectures by the Bretons is part of the whole fraudulent debate being promoted.
Okay. Thank you. I think at this point we should give them an opportunity to reply. I think you have probably been able to hear the comments, and therefore I will not endeavor to repeat them, but I will ask our speakers to comment on your comments.
Well, I haven't quite finished them.
Well, I think that we must proceed because there are many other people who wish to ask questions.
Is to oppose both the unity fraud of Trudeau and the independence fraud of Lévesque. The Vancouver student movement, student wing of the Communist Party of Canada, Marxist-Leninist, announced in the administration of UBC, the Vancouver student movement, that the Vancouver Institute, who are participating in this fraudulent debate, were organizing a series of lectures.
Thank you. Your 30 seconds are now up. Would you care to comment on that? Or
very briefly.
We'll comment very, very briefly.
Comment briefly, yeah. Well, I think I'll comment very briefly on that. There's a couple of points that you made, actually, that I would agree with. In fact, as Albert pointed out, at the very beginning of the presentation is that it's true that the poor have no concern with these kinds of issues. We certainly recognize that. In fact, this allows us to locate the problem at a certain level in society. And it's also true that, as we mentioned throughout the discussion, in fact, that the issue of the distribution and redistribution of organizational control is among various peoples who hold organizational control or who aspire to hold organizational control. Now, the other aspect of your question, which is essentially the criticism of what we're doing, is that we are giving importance to the linguistic and regional cleavage in the country, while we should be concerned with the class cleavage in the country. And I don't see why there's a necessary opposition. I don't see why we have to deny the existence of the linguistic cleavage and the conflicts that occurred there to recognize a class conflict, or to recognize a conflict, class conflict, you have to deny the other. You're putting the whole thing as if it was mutually exclusive, and I don't think this is the case. It's true, though, that when you have a conflict between, people in the different linguistic communities or regional communities, the class cleavages and the people who are if you wish, entrepreneurs along this line of cleavage. You are promoting their own attempts at organizational control along that line. They feel a bit out of the picture. And it is a frustrating thing. In fact, in a way, referring to the facetious comment that was made at the beginning, if we don't talk about the sex cleavage, the people who are concerned with the sex cleavage in society, they feel a bit left out of the picture. And at the moment, it's probable that the feminist militants, just like the class militants, feel that they don't have the are not at the forefront of the public debate in Canada. But that's not my decision. I think this is something which is occurring in the society, and we are reading society in a certain way.
The question that has been raised concerns essentially the economic situation in which the farmer or the producer of farm products finds himself, and the assertion that that is one of the primary problems rather than a linguistic group problem, if I understand the questioner correctly. Would you care to comment?
Well, I think I can only repeat what Raymond said a while ago. The diagnosis that there exists a problem cannot in any way be taken as a denial of the existence of another problem. The fact that we've been talking about the relationship between language and regional communities in Canada is no denial and cannot be taken as a denial that there is unemployment in Canada. It cannot be taken as a denial that the distribution of income may not be the one that one likes. It cannot be taken as a denial that the stock exchange does not always behave the way one would like, etc. But when we talk about linguistic and regional communities, we talk of one class of problems. And to refer to the point that Raymond made made, which I think is an important one, and I would like to emphasize it a little bit, because the same kind of preoccupations seems to be coming back. Along all the lines that differentiate society, it is not a bad way to look at the world as if along all these lines, there were a bunch of social and political entrepreneurs who are there to propound ideologies, to mobilize people, and to try to improve their own condition and that of the people of their groups. It's always disturbing for these individuals. It's essentially bad luck. It's nature playing against them, to use your example about the Saskatchewan farmers. It's nature playing against them when old boy René Lévesque gets elected on the 15th of November, and by God, it raises the level of the ethnic, or the linguistic cleavage in Canada. It raises the possibility that Quebec could secede, and some people may want Quebec to secede, but some others don't. And consequently, the fact that there are some on either side of the linguistic frontier who wish and
that it leaves or that it stays in, is a potential for conflict. This is what we have been talking about. It makes it very hard for those guys along the other lines. It is true that if for a very long time in Canada, the linguistic problem remains and the regional problem remains, it may come to a point, to use the example of John Helliwell gave to us, that capitalists and workers may start talking to each other, and we will not be able to raise all hell about the conflicts between them. And that's too bad for those guys who live on the exploitation of the conflicts between these social classes. It makes it tough for them. It is true that the way the social world and the political world, as well as the economic world, evolves, that it provides opportunities sometimes from some individuals and sometimes for others. And then you have a drastic shift, and those people who were playing the feminist drum at one point, or were playing the class drum at another point, or playing some other thing, find themselves robbed of opportunities they would otherwise have had, or they thought they had, and they are being robbed by guys who are exploiting another line of differentiation in society, which they need not have themselves brought about, but which we would be naive to the ultimate to believe that they're going to try to eliminate, since they are the entrepreneurs exploiting that particular opportunity.
Essentially is, are there more profitable exchanges taking place now between the two linguistic groups, and is this becoming a more significant factor?
Well, according to what I said tonight, one would hypothesize that there would be more exchanges between the two communities, either economic or political or otherwise, as a result of the fact that there is a group of bilinguals, and in fact the number of bilinguals, either of people whose mother tongue is English or French, has been increasing in recent years. Although I'm not too sure, it's been increasing among the Anglophones, I'm not too sure it's been increasing among the Francophones in Canada as a whole. But there is a class among the Francophones of bilinguals. There's been one for a long time. I really don't know what is, in fact, the situation in this regard. As I mentioned, in that study I've been working on, we've been trying to find studies to find out to what extent actually exchanges have been taking place, and can we impute them to the existence of bilinguals. We couldn't find any such studies. So we are really at a loss. So I think we need to know more information about that. But I would hypothesize that yes, they would be playing a role of some sort.
Somehow shape my perception I have the feeling that Canada, in particular Ottawa, is a feudal society, and that the people in Ottawa are the lords of the manor, and that in essence every little fiefdom, which we can call a province, is again the lord of the manor. If we in British Columbia had sufficient integrity or sufficient gumption, we would want to secede from Canada. Alberta, likewise, Saskatchewan, everyone really is dissatisfied, but it seems that we have cottoned on to the issue of bilingualism and these differences. You see, these people there's a great deal of similarity that they have with our problem here, but we tend to have a smokescreen, and for the moment, all of us are united against them. But I'm saying that if we looked into our own human condition here in British Columbia, we would, I get back to this basic thing, we would secede too, because we are dissatisfied with what happens. And what I'm asking is, do you think, really, under the present system that we're operating, that there really is any reason to continue to exist this way?
We
need some massive housing.
The question is Canada perceived as a feudal society with the provinces as fiefdoms? Is this not unsatisfactory, and do our speakers feel that there is any reason to proceed as we now are?
Well, I guess that was the a little bit the essence of our analysis, that in fact the various groups in the various regions of the country, provinces, are dissatisfied with the distribution of power in the country. You've located that power in Ottawa. We would locate it in a much more broad way. I think, as Albert pointed out, the political power is only one aspect of the relevant source of power. There is power in all the different institutional domain in the society, and that power has a certain distribution, and what you're saying is that what we've been saying is that it is considered by many individuals, and you seem to be one of them in fact, who is dissatisfied with that distribution of power and would like to rearrange things, or else you say, well, maybe we should quit being a country. And the issue is, will it be possible for the country to find ways of effecting this redistribution without generating too much conflict, without, you know, being destroying too much of our own resources and organizations? And in fact, that's the test that we're facing in the moment. And it's a test of a conflict of power. And whether those people using different kinds of strategies, such as the one Albert mentioned, corporate strategies or political strategies, social strategies, social political strategies, whether these strategies will be effective is really the issue. And that is something that is very difficult to predict. Whether they'll be effective or not, it depends on how they use them, how much support they are able to actually mobilize, whether the ideologies they propound to mobilize the Westerners actually mobilize enough Westerners, etc.
I think we will have three more questions. Yes, up here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've listened carefully, even desperately, to search for some sort of an answer in what you have both said tonight that focuses on the enormous economic problems that are existing in Canada. I feel that your discussion is very interesting, drawing room conversation, but I don't think you've come anywhere near the problem. You seem to project the problem as being purely a linguistic and a cultural problem. For myself, I can't help wondering if you have skirted the whole thing, and really, basically, it's an economic problem.
The question was, is it not more of an economic problem than the speakers have emphasized?
Well, the first point I would like to make is that we have tried, and I'm very sorry that I've not been able to put across the point, that it was not a linguistic problem. This has been the entire burden of our discussion, that we are not dealing with a linguistic problem. Okay? That's point one. Point two is that I do not know exactly what you have in mind when you talk about our current economic problems. But the fact that if you mean by our current economic problems such things as the current rate of inflation, the current level of unemployment, the current deficit in the balance of payments, and things of that kind, they are serious problems. But it's very difficult, indeed I think impossible, to associate these problems with the kind of tensions which we believe exist in Canada for a number of reasons. First, the tensions have existed for a longer time than the kind of problems we're talking about. The kinds of problems we've talked with, the kind of economic problems, and I hope that the ones I've listed are the ones you have in mind, the kind of economic problems that I've listed to try to give content to the sentence, our current economic problems, are problems which were not with us in exactly that form very long ago, and certainly not as long as the tensions that we try to identify have been with us. Secondly, the problems of inflation, the problems of unemployment, and the problems of balance of payments also characterize the Italian economy. They also characterize the French economy. And they characterize many economies in the world, but it seems to me very difficult to associate these with any of the kinds of things, of tensions we have been talking about, in particular when we look at these other countries. Again, in concluding, I wish to stress that what we've been saying is not a denial of the existence of economic problems, but I would like to warn that a solution to Canada's economic problems is not going to resolve the problems of the demands that the organizations of Western Canada are placing with respect to the role that they want to play in the economic management of affairs in Canada. And it's not going to resolve the problems that exist with respect to the linguistic communities either.
The question is, how much more of our individual liberty may we have to give up to maintain our current, I presume, national entity?
Could you be more specific?
In terms of the current expose of the RCMP trying to keep the country together by dividing it, the Central Intelligence Agency working with the RCMP to persecute individuals who
try to
who are
unliberal or
anti-liberal or enemies of the
I'm not sure it's germane.
Is that clear enough?
Yeah, briefly.
Is it clear?
Well, the way I see it, I think, is that I would respond, if Albert allows me, the same thing as you responded to the previous question. You're raising the problem of the role of the police in the society. And it seems to me that the role of the police in the society is not unique to Canada in 1977 and 78. It's a problem which is fundamental to all societies, particularly critical perhaps in a democratic society, or at least it presents itself in a special way. And I think we should be concerned with these kinds of problems. We should always be concerned with those kinds of problems. But I don't think it is critical in the kind of discussions that we've been presenting tonight. But that doesn't mean that we deny the existence and the severity of that problem and the need to attend to it.
In view of the Anglophone society's desire to gain more organizational control, would you care to comment briefly on the attitude of the Quebec government and its regulations vis-a-vis the Sun Life Assurance Company?
The question has been asked in view of the Anglophone Society's desire to obtain or maintain control. Would our speakers comment on the situation with respect to the Sun Life Insurance Company?
In that case, you're right. It's the Anglophone community, in this case, particularly in Quebec, it's more localized in the Quebec case, wishes to maintain its organizational system. And in fact, as a result of a number of events in Quebec society, including, but not only, of a legislative order, such as the language legislation, I think there are more developments that have occurred in Quebec in recent years, which have rendered made the Anglophone community sort of nervous. And you're right, they've been made nervous in terms of the maintenance of their organizational system. We know, for example, that our teachers in the Protestant School Board of Montreal are very nervous that their organizational structure is being slowly eroded. I would suspect that the academics in the universities, the Anglophone universities in Quebec, similarly. In the case of the Sun Life, I'm not too sure what the decision is anymore. Apparently it's being considered, but the initial statement by the president of the Sun Life was imputing its decision to the language legislation. It's the, to my mind, the interesting reaction in this case is that on the one hand, the Francophone community seemed to have reacted sort of negatively to that decision. And in fact, Mr. Parizeau tried to dissociate the decision of the Sun Life from the language legislation. But the interesting thing is that there was a pretty strong reaction. I must say this occurred so recently, and we haven't been able to follow the papers all that closely for whatever information they provide. It seems that the Anglophone community in Montreal has reacted sort of strongly, that they're afraid that the Sun Life decision, in fact, is going to harm them more than it's going to harm Quebec as a whole, or at least as much as it's going to affect Quebec as a whole. That is, the Sun Life decision is some sort of symbolic of some elites in the Anglophone organizational system as having decided that, well, they wouldn't fight it back, they wouldn't fight it anymore. And there's a lot of pressure on the Anglophones. Well, you know, if those who want to stay in Quebec, they say, well, look, we've got to stop this, because if all those organizations start leaving, it's our organizational system that's going to be slowly becoming weakened and weakened and weakened. See? So...